We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
Hi everybody, I'm Nick Kane.
And I'm Lauren Bailey, and thanks for listening.
This is the first podcast in the Act of Storytelling series, so we thought we should tell you a little bit about ourselves and what we're hoping to do with this podcast.
So Nick and I worked together on a show for the Melbourne Fringe Festival last year, and we got talking about the Act of Storytelling, the different ways we tell our own stories, and what we can learn from listening to other people's stories.
So from that initial thought, we decided to launch this podcast series to entertain and enlighten and answer some of our own questions and give people the opportunity to ask some of theirs too.
We'll be interviewing a new storyteller each month and we'll share each new podcast on the 10th of the month.
Yeah, so we've started this podcast to find out more about the stories we all tell and to understand some of the different motivations that drive us as storytellers. And hopefully along the way, we can strengthen the sense of community that we share.
So to get started, let's talk a little bit about our own stories.
Okay, well, I'll start. I'm originally a country boy. I moved to the city when I was 18. I consider myself a multifaceted storyteller too. So whilst I do have acting and music, I guess, there is also another corporate side to me as well that works through producing and creative strategy. So hopefully there's a bit of diversity in the way I tell stories and the way that I find interest in stories too. I originally found performance through music, actually, through a heavy metal band called Masochist.
Nice.
One day, one of my teachers actually came and saw the show and said, "Hey, your show's very theatrical. You really should audition for our school play." So back in the day, I was a little bit rock and roll, so I was kind of like, no, I don't want to do that. But I did. I went along and I auditioned and I got the part, well, the lead role in the show.
Fantastic. So what was the show?
It was a show called Curse of the Mummy. And not the one you're thinking. It was a comedy, slapstick comedy, basically.
Nice. Not rock and roll at all.
Not rock and roll at all.
Well, I'm a Melburnian through and through. I've done my stint in London, but I've pretty much been working more or less steadily here over the last 15 years or so. I have a strong theatre background, but I guess for the last 7 or 8 years I've been trying to do more and more screen work. My first role, I just thought it was worth mentioning, my first paid role, sorry, I was the Easter Bunny for one golden hour at McLeod Village Shops.
Was the one golden hour the name of the show, or was it just one
golden
hour?
No, that's just how I describe it. It was one hot golden hour.
Fantastic.
I kept going back into where I started to take the bunny head off so that I could breathe. But anyway, that didn't dull my enthusiasm. And I'm still here. You're all super glad, I can tell.
That's great. I remember my first role. It was a theatre in education show, and I still to this day, this is a little bit of a nerd-like quality in me, but I laminated the check, the first check, and it's still sitting in my bedroom in
really?
A little, yeah, in a little shoebox of Nick's acting goodies.
Oh, it's only a little box?
Yeah, at the moment.
At the moment.
Hope it gets a bit bigger.
So there's definitely been, I don't know about you, Nick, but a lot of ups and downs for me over the years. So I've wrestled with this thing that is being an actor.
Mm.
I guess I'm gradually discovering that maybe those ups and downs, that's what it's all about. I mean, I know they say that. They say, enjoy the journey, learn to love auditions. You know, you hear all this stuff when you're starting out, but I just wish someone would explain to you it's not about the big break. Mm. It's about loving what you do, loving the storytelling.
I love that because I went to LA maybe 2 years ago and I went over there, you know, going, okay, this is the opportunity, you know. I went over there and as you know, Lauren, it's just a different world over there.
Yeah.
And it's big business and you can get lost quite easily. And I felt like I was in a crossroads of what am I doing here, you know? And I really, there's points where I really didn't enjoy it. But I think the one thing for me was then coming back and going, well, why are you doing this? You're not necessarily doing it for the big break. You're doing it because you're loving it, and you do it because hopefully other people feel connected.
You want to share something with people.
Correct. Yeah. So I think that's where you've got to find where you as an artist really lies.
Yeah, I definitely think those big industries overseas, on one hand, it's really motivating. You see all this opportunity, all this possibility, you know, everyone's doing it. But then on the other hand, there is that thing of everyone's doing it. And there's 100 other people who look like you who might have more experience. So yeah, you've got to find your own personal reason to keep going.
Bit of a reason why we're doing this show too, Lauren, isn't it? I mean, we want people to be able to at least experience other people's stories and hopefully learn and...
You know, the opportunity to make people think and feel, like, that really excites me.
That
just
is what
there's
it's all
so
about.
So few professions where you get to do both.
Mm. So this is the podcast. So welcome.
Thanks for joining us. And who are we interviewing this month?
Yeah, so our very first interview is with theatre maker Adam J.A. Cass. So he's written a heap of theatre shows. He won the 2007 Melbourne Dramatists Emerging Writers Award for one of his shows. I Love You Bro was the name of the show. It was nominated for the 2007 Green Room Award for Best New Australian Writing, and later nominated for the 2010 Matilda Award for Best Main Stage Production. And new productions are just happening all over the world with that. It's a huge show.
He's also a performer and director, a member of the Green Room Awards Independent Theatre Judging Panel, and a committee member at La Mama Theatre in Carlton.
And we are about to find out what storytelling means to him.
We're here today with Adam Cass in Carlton. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
You were saying before this house is a little bit of the dinky house in between all the millionaires' houses.
Yeah, that's right. I really, really, really like the house, but if you looked at it from the outside, it looks very small compared to all the other houses. You see tourists sort of walk by all the houses and look at all the great things and they look at houses in a different way.
Yeah, but it's kind of Carlton kitsch, I reckon.
Yeah, it's got it a is. Nice I mean, I, like, I love it. I love it. Mm. I mean, yeah.
So we are interviewing Adam here at his house today because you do a lot of your writing at home, don't you?
I do, yeah, I would say all of my writing at home. Yeah, once upon a time I used to go to cafes and write, and I used to go home to my mum's house in the country and write, but now it's pretty much, this is the only place I can write, I think, yeah.
So today, Adam, we're going to talk about your role as an Australian storyteller, how you started your career, what drives you, and why you believe that storytelling is important.
Yeah, and we started off, first of all, by asking Adam to write a paragraph about his story. So this is a bit of a personal perspective to give a bit of an insight into Adam's own personal unique story. So, Adam, go for it.
I was born in Frankston 42 years ago, raised by a single mum and my grandma. Moved to the country and went to high school in Maryborough in the heart of Victoria, which is the place I tell people I come from, even though I only lived there for 8 years or so. We were very poor and I had no ambition or expectation of any kind of future. I was afraid of everything in the world until I found theatre. I auditioned for and got into a performing arts course at the TAFE school in Ballarat, and during the curtain call for the very first performance I did, I felt the applause get louder for me than it was for others on stage. From that moment, I was hooked to the idea of, I suppose, giving an audience something that they really want to clap for or cry over or laugh with. And it's from that angle that I approach everything I do as a writer and actor and director. And even with the one unpublished novel that I've written, I was picturing the whole time as I wrote the person who might read my words and hopefully experience some kind of transforming event while they're doing so. Still, it's a bit odd to talk about myself as a storyteller because I never sit down to tell any particular story. All I'm trying to do with the work that I make is to create some kind of interesting or entertaining or complexly funny or sad or both truth to try to pay back that very first audience of mine who sparked things in me, ideas and dreams, possibilities and ambitions that nothing else ever had.
Thanks for being honest there, Adam. And the first thing I want to raise off the back of that is your childhood. Because you spoke a little bit about Frankston, that you did spend a bit of time in Frankston, but you classed Maryborough as the place that you came from, or the one that, I guess, resonated with you.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of memories of Frankston. I moved out of Frankston probably when I was 11, I suppose. So it was kind of the time that of my growing up years, it sort of split halfway down the middle. But I suppose high school was where I formed more links that have lasted in my life and more ideas of who I was and what who I wanted to be or didn't want to be, especially, probably.
Yeah. And you also mentioned, you said you felt like you came from a fairly poor background as well, and that it was something that, no ambition at that stage, but you sort of found the theatre and
yeah,
it was something.
Yeah, I mean, poor, financially poor. Like, there were other ways in which we were kind of always rich because education, I guess, was, my mum was really, really educated. She was the only one, actually, in my family who was educated, but I feel like that kind of had this sort of richness to it, the fact that education was always such an important thing. But we didn't, we had times when we didn't have electricity or running water, or the only things we had to eat were the eggs that our chickens would lay, or the chickens themselves. It's not like, I'm not saying that as this kind of sad thing or anything like that. It's just, it definitely, though, has informed where I've come from and the ambition, I guess, that I sort of didn't have. I never thought that I would progress beyond that, I guess.
So you started out studying performing arts and you just describe yourself as a writer, actor and director. So Nick and I did a little bit of research before today, and in terms of the information that is available about you online and in printed press, you seem to be publicly recognised as a writer. Is this how you predominantly identify yourself?
I predominantly recognise myself as a theatre maker. The information that might be online about me, I think writers get more stuff said about them in the media. It's more interesting story for journalists sometimes to talk to writers or talk about writers or reviewers to talk about writers, and other kind of roles seem to get forgotten probably. But also I write as Adam J. A. Cass, and there's kind of only one of me, but there's heaps of Adam Casses, so it's probably harder to find information about Adam Cass, I guess. But
you say as a writer too, because it's quite interesting. In an article that we found, it says that you've written over 40 plays, but you've been involved with over 200, which means that that's as a writer, actor, director, whatever it might be, but it's a lot of content there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've constantly, since I did my performing arts course, since I finished it in, I guess, what was it, 92? I'm looking at you as if you know the answer to that.
It was 92, yes.
Yeah, it was 1992. How old were you then?
Plenty of research,
Since I finished that course, I've pretty much constantly been making something, maybe except for 1 year in 2010 when I decided to kind of have the year off. In the early years, I was working on maybe 10 shows a year, or not actually sort of in the middle years. I was working on about 10 shows a year, and I guess they add up, you know. For me, it's just what I do. It's not like I wouldn't actually be able to tell you how many shows I've worked on, because it's just all kind of one long show in some ways.
Yeah. Is that important? Do you think that's important as a storyteller to tell, just continue to tell stories?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like anything. It's like any role that we people take on in life, the more you do it, the better you do it. The more you feel comfortable doing it, the more kind of, I suppose, you feel like your voice or whatever it is in other jobs has weight, actually means something, that and other people kind of listen to you more. So, yeah, I think it is very important to keep on doing it, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and so you say you did about 10 shows a year in the middle years, but in the last few years you've had quite a few shows that are sort of more publicly recognised.
Yeah, I think actually the kind of the bigger doors that open for you, and the further you go up that ladder, the less you actually do, and the longer time you take over each thing, probably the more stressful everything becomes, the greater weight it sort of carries on you. And so I probably have done less in the last 2 or 3 years, but it probably speaks louder maybe than all the other things.
And can you tell us about some of those shows?
Well, in the last, I mean, the most recent sort of, I guess, highlight of my career I've had was a play called Rome that I wrote with Red Stitch Actors Theatre and developed with them and Gary Abrahams, the dramaturg, over 2 years or so. And that was, that was a long time working on it and it was a big deal. It was a really exciting adventure, I guess, the whole thing. I made another show with Red Stitch sort of in that same period called Behind Closed Doors, which was written with Melbourne's Flinders Quartet, who are a fantastic string quartet. Mm. The play that I'm best known for is a play called I Love You, Bro. I realised yesterday, I was just thinking about this yesterday, that I wrote that like nearly 9 years ago now. Mm. And so I suppose it's been around for a while, but it's still the play that people would know me for, I suppose.
Still extremely successful, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Still touring, doing
shows.
Well,
since it was first on in the Fringe Festival in Melbourne in 2007, I think it's had a production either on or in preparation, you know, the preparation stage of being on somewhere in the world since then. And that's still happening, so, yeah.
So is that a published script that we can get our hands on, or
it's just actually 2 days ago. I just got an email from publishers saying, "Okay, we've got everything we need now. We're about to go to press." So yeah, it's just being published, which is it may be too late. I don't know, because in the kind of when it was being done in Australia a lot, I often had teachers writing to me saying, "Where can I get a copy of your script?" And other people, and like I could have sold a lot of copies for a while there, and they've slowed down. So I don't know if I'll sell any copies, but it's still exciting to be published. And I just mean too late in terms of there's no productions actually on in Australia at the moment, and it's being published by a Queensland publisher, Playlab Indie Publishers are publishing it, and so it's probably there aren't any kind of productions where people would go, "Oh, I love that play, I want to get it." But I think it still is a play that has currency in the world and still speaks as loudly as it ever did, maybe even more so now. So I mean, I think it's a really good example of the kind of play that I want to make in terms of what it does for an audience. It's not necessarily the kind of story that I want to tell, I guess. It's not necessarily in the kind of genre where I'm comfortable working or stylistically that I'm comfortable working, but in terms of how it has impacted on an audience, it has done all those things that I say I want to do with my theatre, I think. And that was really exciting to find out that it was doing that.
Let's talk about the truths in your work, if we can, a little bit. You know, there's a couple that are through a couple of your plays. So, you know, I'm looking at sort of escapism, this idea of dislocation. Is that something that's come from your own life? Are you finding these truths from your own life, or are these something that you write about just generally?
Is that more a comment on the society?
Well, I mean, when I say that I Love You, Bro is a play that's not necessarily the kind of story I want to tell, it's because it actually is a true story that happened to somebody else, I suppose. And so I feel like it's based on a true story that happened to somebody else. So I feel like I've kind of hijacked somebody else's truth in some ways. But the way I think I made that play successful was by putting myself inside that story and making it a what-if scenario for me. Like, how is this story true for me? And how would I possibly behave in this circumstance? And I think that's kind of how I approach all of my work. It's about it's about my truth but I think all of us, like if we're talking about dislocation and being an outsider and sort of desperation and lovesickness and all these things that a lot of my work has in it, that's kind of everyone's story, really. Yeah. Like, or that's I guess when I sit down to write, that's kind of what I have in my head. It's what I tell myself anyway. Like, almost all of us would say we are outsiders. Mm. You know, there are very few people in this world who would say they're an insider.
Yeah.
So I'm talking to most of us when I write about outsiders, I suppose. So yeah.
So it's finding a bit of a universal truth there, I guess.
That's the idea, is to find something that isn't necessarily a sexy sort of story about now. It's this thing that actually makes sense always to all of us. And yeah, like the play I Love You, Bro, the real guy who was involved in the story that's based on thought of that story publicly, called that story, it was Romeo and Juliet to him. He was Juliet. And it's true. That's what that story is. It's Romeo and Juliet, and that story gets told over and over and over again. So, yeah.
So we've just finished working on a script together for This Is What It Feels Like that's opening at La Mama in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
Do you feel like, you know, through that process, we've explored some of those truths and how successful we've been at that?
And when you say we, you mean you and me, Lauren. So Lauren Bailey, Adam Gass, Nick had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I had nothing to do with it.
That was definitely our goal. I mean, wasn't it? Like that was when we sat down to say what sort of play we wanted to make. They were all the things that we talked about. They were. It was about finding. I mean, we sat down to make a play, and this was your suggestion about the loneliest woman in the world. And really, it's kind of like every person, every character in the play, and every person in the world is the loneliest person in the world. We have no choice. Like, it is true that we come into the world alone and that we leave alone, and that all of life is a kind of is a search for connection with other souls. But you can never have really true connection because everyone is alone. You know, and that's a cynical way of looking at it.
Maybe sounds pretty heavy.
It's a heavy way of looking at it. Maybe it's a sad way of looking at it. Maybe, but I tend to take the other view. I tend to kind of think it's a really beautiful, exciting thing that we are this kind of unique bubble floating around this ocean of other bubbles, and that any other bubble that we interact with is in itself a unique experience and a really exciting experience. It actually means that while we're alive, there is an endless possibilities for adventure with other people. And that to me is exciting.
It's great. To be honest, yeah, it really is. It's quite funny. If it does very well, I'll edit out that bit that said I wasn't involved. but that's interesting too, because with a new piece of theatre coming up for you, as a writer, let's talk about that and talking about your work and thinking about, are you ever thinking about how it's going to go in the theatre or how it's going to be received or any of those thoughts?
All I think about, the only thing I think about in terms of transforming it from something that's, well, in your head, because I'm thinking about this when I'm putting it on the page as well, is it going to connect with an audience member in any way? And I suppose the only way of doing that is by putting myself in the audience and thinking, would I connect with it?
Yeah.
Or would the people I kind of think I know pretty well connect with it? And so I suppose everything is about making every moment of the script and then the play have some kind of connecting kind of truth to it. And that's the really, really, really tough thing. And, you know, we're rehearsing it now. We open in 3 weeks and it's kind of the stage of rehearsal where you kind of think, well, actually, nothing is speaking. Nothing is making those moments. Nothing's happening. As we're at that really messy stage of rehearsal where it feels like a kind of like a massive failure. But it's not... Like the attempt is all you need to make. I have faith that we're going to get past that really messy phase. But the attempt is all you need to make. It's the attempt of making that connection that's important. It's not actually if you make that connection, that's a rare, rare thing.
Mm.
Really, it is. And it's glorious when you do it, but it's the attempt that's important, I think.
And so can you talk more about, you know, obviously we wrote this script together, but I'm now just acting in it, which is a bit of a sidestep for me to go from writer to actor. Can you talk about your step from going from writer to director and, you know, how that changes your perspective of the piece and the challenges involved?
I actually think it's a funny thing because, you know, I was a co-writer with you, Lauren, but I'm directing it by myself. So I feel in some ways like I've got more ownership over how to tell the story now, and it's obviously, all the actors have their own kind of ownership with it as well. But I feel like in the rehearsals now, I've kind of been a little bit unleashed. Like I feel like there's a lot of freedom in how to make things happen that we always talked about. We wanted to make happen.
Yeah.
And I've been really gratified in rehearsal every time I've gone on this kind of jaunt of like, this is what I think it should be. I see you nodding, you know, if you're in the room, and it feels like we are on the same page, even though it's only me saying those things. And I think I am trusting my director voice more than I trust my writer voice when I'm writing with someone else.
Well, quick one for that as well. I just want to talk about collaboration as well, because that's a really good point, because you're talking about working together and it seems like you two have a fantastic connection in that regards. It does make it easier to have a great connection, but do you find it's easy to write by yourself or with someone like that?
Because you collaborated in different ways on the Registered Project.
Yeah. It's much, 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 much easier to write by yourself. Much, much, much easier. And for yourself. It's like kind of like, you know, you live or die on your own kind of sword or whatever. Mm. And it's much easier. It may not be as rewarding and it may not bring as much stuff out of you. So, yeah, I mean, it's not meant to be easy, as they say, or whatever. But it's definitely, it is a harder thing to contemplate writing with someone else. And I had this rehearsal the other day with Lauren and one of the other actors, Kasia Kaczmarek, and she's fantastic. And they both were having this really, engaging conversation where everything that Lauren and I did was being questioned and being like all these challenges. And I felt like I had answers for those challenges. And I felt like the conversation itself was going to make the piece stronger. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, if only I could speak with this kind of freedom when I was in the room with Gary Abrahams, the dramaturg of the Red Stitch show. I was like, I reckon Gary would love seeing me like this, because I probably never trusted my voice enough when I was making the work with them.
I mean, having said that, I saw Rome, so it was still a great show, and it was successful.
I mean, it was successful, and I'm really, really, really proud that it was made. I'm really happy with it. I loved working with Red Stitch. They were so wonderful to me. But I think Gary and I both would say that in the late stages of that process, we both weren't trusting what way to go with it, and probably it could have been a much, much stronger piece of theatre in a way if we had have. You know? So, I mean, I maybe shouldn't say all that stuff, but like I think it wouldn't be a shock to Gary or to anyone, me saying that. So
that's great. It's honesty.
Yeah. So in terms of talking about the different ways we tell stories, and you were talking about how unique everyone is, this idea that we're all doing our own thing. In Australia, as a storyteller in Australia, do you believe that we have a unique story to tell as a culture or...?
Of course we've got a unique story to tell as a culture, because we are, on the surface of things, a unique culture because of how, again, isolated we are from the whole world and how far away we are from the whole world. But I'm not a card-carrying, flag-waving Australian in that way. I was really struck when I was a kid. I'm a big cricket fan. And I remember Imran Khan, who was this fantastic Pakistani cricketer and also kind of like a... He's now really heavily involved in politics in Pakistan. But he said the only place for nationalism, the only place where nationalism should exist, is in sport, because in sport there are no consequences. It's just a game. But anytime you kind of take that nationalism anywhere else, it kind of becomes this ugly thing, saying we are better than you or we're worse than you. You know, we have this to say to the world and not this, or more than you. And you know, I think of myself as, especially now with how, you know, democratized or whatever the world is becoming, I feel like I am part of the planet and who we all are. So, and I feel like I'm also just myself. I always want Australia to win sport. I cheer very loudly. Last night, Australia won a very close game of cricket and I was cheering very loudly. But I'm not someone who thinks that Australia is particularly unique in how we tell stories, or needs to be, or I want them to be. I just want us to tell great stories. And that's what it's all about. You know, it's just telling the great stories. And it really doesn't matter who tells them, to be honest. I want there to be great stories. Yeah.
And you're exactly right. So a global perspective on storytelling. So let's ask storytellers. Who inspires you? Have you got any that you particularly...
My favourite all-time writer, and the writer who really hits me in the guts every time I read him, is Kurt Vonnegut. And it's a funny thing to say, probably, because I can, as I've got older, I can look at his writing and all the stuff I've read about him as a person, and I think, well, you know what, I think your ideas maybe are a little bit not misogynistic, but a little bit male-dominated in some ways. And he absolutely, when he wrote about Americans and he wrote about America. And I think it seems like in some ways his writing doesn't really pay attention to the rest of the world or the fact that other people in the world were reading him. But he also, everything he wrote was, everything he wrote, there was some, one of these universal human truths in everything he wrote that hit me in the gut in a, this bittersweet, wonderful way. Everything he's ever written has been like that. And kind of everything I've ever read about him has been like that too. Despite himself, he was this kind of globalist kind of human writer who told exactly the kind of stories I want to tell. And also the playwright Edward Albee, probably as a playwright, Edward Albee would be, I think, the one who I kind of most admire.
So you've seen a lot of those productions.
Edward Albee's ones?
Yeah.
No, I never have. I've read his plays, and I've seen the movie of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But actually, one of the things that I really love Edward Albee for, I was going through a really, really hard time a few years ago, and I was having a kind of a 2 years long conflict about I suppose ownership of a play that I'd written and kind of what the writer's role was in making theatre. And I found some stuff that Edward Albee had written about the role of the writer and how important it is and how, you know, everything kind of comes from the idea that the writer has. The writer serves that idea and then everything else serves that. And I mean, I'm putting it really, really badly, but I would encourage any writer to kind of Google Edward Albee and things he said about writing. You might not agree with it, but I think there's some comfort in some of the things he said. So,
what kind of things, can I ask? Is there any in particular that you?
He's pretty hard bummed about it.
Yeah.
He's pretty hard about it in terms of like he, and I don't agree with this all of this at all. But he sees that directing and acting are both interpretive arts. They're not creative arts. The creation is made by, and I don't agree with that, by the way. Yeah. I think there's creation involved in all aspects of theatre, and I think it definitely is an art form which is made stronger by the creative ideas of everyone involved. Yeah. I definitely think that, but I also think that there is a real Maybe this is unique to Australia. Maybe I only see this because I am in Australia. There seems to be this thing that happens where directors get hold of a writer's script and feel like they know better than the writer about how words work. And so they feel real ownership over changing those words or cutting those words or cutting out huge chunks of a script. And I feel like that's this kind of arrogant ownership over this process, that just because you're in the room here with these people, you think, you know.
Yeah, there's something in that idea of furthering the creation rather than changing the creation.
Yeah.
If the writing is a starting point to an idea, how do I grow that idea rather than change it?
And I'm definitely not a writer who thinks you should never change words. I absolutely think you should change words if it makes the words better, if it makes the script better. You would have seen that in the rehearsal room, Lauren.
Yeah.
We've changed heaps of stuff we've written in the rehearsal room. But I also think that it's a very easy thing for directors and actors to do, to go, oh, that doesn't really fit in with my thoughts, or I don't really understand what the writer's doing with this, so I'm just going to get rid of that. And I think it's a really, really, really lazy way of making theatre. And I think a director should never, ever take a play on unless they think that play is ready to be put on. And like if they kind of make that contract within themselves of that play is ready to be put on, it means put that play on. Mm. And I think Edward Albee speaks a lot about that sort of stuff. If you disagree with that, Nick,
I totally agree. I was nodding the whole time throughout just agreeing. Okay. So.
I mean, you know, it is such a hard thing to talk about, like you said, because we are all working in Australia, and also we're not working on every project. A lot of them, we just see the end the finished project that other people have created. But I still think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying.
And something about sticking it through too, because you talk about these areas where they say it doesn't fit or it's not right, but sometimes that's where the beauty happens when you go, it takes you out of your comfort zone and you go, I really want to explore where they were coming from for this. So rather than just
make this
cutting it
myself
out and going, this doesn't work, find that within yourself, find that personalization.
And like, obviously writers are fallible like everyone else, but people should, in this kind of this process where everyone has their role, be aware of how those roles work together and how they
interact.
Don't work.
So just going back a little bit to this idea that you brought up in the story you read at the start, but also that's sort of come up through this interview, of paying back your very first audience. And when you write, you're thinking about how to connect to them. And is that how you continue to find inspiration in what you do? Is that what drives you?
Oh, yeah, I suppose, yeah. I mean, I love feeling an audience in a room, you know? Like, I love the kind of thing of seeing people. I say this often, so it sounds kind of hokey or whatever, but when I see people leaning forward in their seats and leaning forward to get closer to what's happening on stage, not because they're bending over with boredom or tired, but they're kind of almost physically or actually literally physically reaching out to what's happening on stage as if to kind of draw it further into themselves, that is such an exciting thing for me. And I guess I'm at the stage in my career where I'm also can be really, really amused when that doesn't happen. I can be a little bit more philosophical about when I've just written a play or been involved in a play that doesn't do that at all. Like, I kind of I find that I can find the humor in that failure, I suppose. But when it succeeds, when you see that, it is my version of a drug. It is my version of a religion. That's all I need in terms of that kind of high. That's all I need.
And so just going off the back of, I guess, how you prepare and your process as well, you're saying that you visualize the audience. Does that change? I guess you're talking from a writer's perspective there, but does that change when you're acting or when you're directing as far as how you approach a story?
It doesn't change when I'm directing. I mean, I think if I've had, like, if I've written good stuff, which I think I have written some good stuff, I think it's because I write and direct from the memories of when I've acted. I'm writing in some ways for myself or the women I've been in love with in my life to give them an opportunity to say beautiful words on stage. And I want my actors to feel like they're really saying beautiful words on stage. I'm kind of, I guess I'm always trying to work through the actor no matter what role I'm in. I wrote a play quite a long time ago now, but it was one of the female actors, told me on, when I came and saw it, it was in the Adelaide Fringe Festival, and backstage she said, performing your words is like having delicate little lollies dissolving on my tongue. I loved that. It was such a, and she was so wonderful. She did such a wonderful performance, and like, for her to say that to me was like, wow, you know, and it's that kind of thing. I guess I want to give the actors these delicate little lollies to dissolve on their tongue, I suppose.
The actor's writer, so to speak.
Well, I mean, I would love kind of for that to be a thing that people think of me as, you know, like I'd love that because I love actors and I love how it's all put together like that. I love it.
You've talked quite a bit about failure and success. Can we talk more about how you handle that idea of when you do fail and how you stay motivated to keep trying?
Well, no, as I say now, I just laugh at it. Like I can't talk about some of my failures because people might hear this thing. But if I'm in something that I know is an absolute, like involved in something that I know there's an absolute dog, and it's none of the shows that I've talked about so far have been like that, not at all. I think, I mean, I I guess one of the ways I cope with it is not by telling anyone in my life that it's on. And saying if they turn up, it kind of terrifies me. But so that's one of the things of just going, okay, this is just an experience for me. But really, when it comes down to it, it's like it is all one lifetime of making theatre. It's all one thing. And as I said, you like it's not an original thing to say that you learn more from your failure than success. You absolutely do, because it's easier, I guess, to deconstruct how things happened, to pull things apart, I guess, and go, this didn't work because of this and this didn't work because of that. It's kind of easier to see it, I think. I think it's really, really hard to see why things succeed. I think it's because why things succeed, I think they often succeed for a kind of because of just a feeling in the air, or because of what time they're on in the world and what's happening in the world and what's happening in the people who see it and what's happening in yourself when you do it. There's it's really actually hard to pin it down. But when things fail, it's often for reasons that are kind of pretty obvious, you know, like when you look back at it and that they become more obvious. Like, I didn't do that thing. And next time you kind of try and do those things.
So you're obviously very honest with yourself when something happens like that. It's literally, this is what I did wrong. Let's move on.
I mean, I'm not saying it's an instant thing. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. But I definitely don't get heartbroken or.
I think it's really interesting too. You talk about failure, like it's such an absolute, like I often think if you create work, there might be something that just was a little bit, you would do a little bit differently rather than, you know, just writing a story off completely.
Absolutely. I rarely write things off completely. And I've kind of, it's been this thought in my head for the last few years, I reckon, that if there's, and it's not actually so much about my work, it's when I see a lot of theatre. I'm a green room judge and judge for other things, and so I see a lot of theatre, and you see a lot of theatre that leaves you kind of cold and is dull and boring or whatever, but I more and more think that if there's one moment, just one moment in what you see in a movie or a play or a piece of music or an opera, just one moment that has you, one moment that kind of makes you tingle, even if everything around it doesn't, if there's one performer or one performance or one sequence of words or one note of music that kind of lifts you up, then that was really worth being part of. That was worth going to as an audience, because it's kind of like it was a moment of beauty that you hadn't experienced before that. And failure is the wrong word, definitely. But it's more about, I guess, when things don't all come together the way you hoped they had.
When you're a writer, director, you're very much in a bit of a solo career, aren't you? So to get up and to stay motivated about what you're doing, where does that come from for you personally?
Ego, probably. Like the desire to be the best writer in the world. You know, like I guess I have a goal which frustrates my girlfriend in that by the time I die, and I don't intend to die until I'm at least 95, I can look back on my life and I can say I've created one masterful thing. And I know that I haven't created one masterful thing yet. I know that I'm quite a way off creating one masterful thing, but I have lots of the building blocks that are there that could create that thing, and I have faith in myself that I will create that thing. And I want, by the time I die, to create one timeless work that lives forever. And it might not be a play, it might be a novel. I think it's more likely, in my dreams of it, it's more likely going to be a novel. Or even, probably not something that'll live forever, or even a film. but probably more likely a novel is what my dreams all kind of revolve around. And I guess it's this thing of searching for this kind of impossible perfection in some ways. It's like I'm not done doing this yet. So I felt at various times in my career that I have been done. I felt like I don't want to do that anymore. It's too painful. I get too involved. I create unhealthy relationships with the people I'm making the theatre with. It's too much work for no kind of financial rewards at all. Like, there are no financial rewards at all. There is sometimes money that comes in, but it's not a financial reward. It's just some money. Yeah.
It can't be why you do it.
No, basically. It's definitely not why you do it. And and so, like, there have been times when it has been too much for me, but I guess I've worked through those times, or I hope I have, and it's just now a search for creating that thing.
That's another thing too, because you were talking about a novel, and you do have an unpublished novel sitting there over there on your dressing table pretty much, don't you?
I do.
Yeah,
that's right.
Is that the masterpiece is the question?
No, that's not the masterpiece. That is I think one of the better pieces of writing I've done, and I think it's got things in there that I think are like things that I'm really, really proud of saying and putting into a piece of writing, and I really, really kind of desperately in some ways want more people to read it and go, oh, you know what, this is a really lovely thing that's being said with this novel. But it's not, I can completely understand why the publishers I've sent it to haven't wanted to publish it. I can completely get that. I can't even comprehend or form thoughts about yet what that masterful thing might be. I've got a novel in my head that I've sort of been writing in my head for the last couple of years, and I think that's going to be closer when I finally get it all down, but it's still not going to be it.
It's a bit of a journey, so it's one thing at a time, isn't it?
It's life. I mean, if you're talking about storytellers and any in any form, like it is a lifelong story, you know, that you're telling. I've never met a real honest artist, a real artist in any form, and all artists are storytellers in their own way, who aren't part of a lifelong story. That's what it is. It's not just one piece.
And in your lifelong journey as a storyteller, you've talked a lot about being a writer and a director. Can you compare that to how you feel about telling a story as an actor?
I'm probably a little bit these days, not always, but a little bit lazier about being an actor. I probably don't get as invested. I probably leave all of the kind of hard work up to other people in some ways. And I probably, I'm probably just enjoy being an actor too much. I probably just really.
Are you saying we're lazy?
No, I'm definitely not. I'm saying the good actors do everything that I do as a writer and more that the good actors do. I'm saying that at the moment, maybe I'm not a good actor. in terms of how seriously I take it. If I took acting really seriously, I think I would have been in quite a lot of high profile work, because I think if I had approached my career as an actor the way I did in the first couple of years of being an actor when I was in, you know, drama school, I reckon I could be on any stage in the world right now, because I loved it and I think I was good at it, and I think I knew how to really find the core of a character and really tell a story. But I was it's hard work. Yeah. It's everyday work of voice training and physical training and research but the hardest thing is dealing every day with rejection. It's going out into the world and being rejected over and over and over again, trying to find the right niche for you. You're not rejected because you're bad. You're rejected because you don't suit the niche of those people on that day. Well, sometimes you're rejected because you're bad.
Not us, Lauren. No, no, not
you looked at me.
Yeah. But no, I just guess I didn't. I haven't worked on that enough, I suppose.
You're a green room judge, is another string to your bows. A boardroom member for the La Mama Theatre, and you work with Platform U Theatre. So you must see a lot of different stories.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how does working with these different groups inspire you and also shape your work?
It inspires me to know that I'm part of a really active theatre community. And I suppose if you're talking about Australian storytellers, I kind of more think of, if I locate something, it's in Melbourne. And I think Melbourne has a really, really active, wonderful, huge, sprawling kind of network of storytellers, of theatre makers. And I'm inspired by that. I am also, I guess you get to see all the different levels and layers of how stories work and how they don't work and how things, it's so amazing to see how many pieces of theatre are made without a single thing being communicated to the audience, without the theatre makers even once thinking I want to communicate something to the audience.
Theatre for theatre's sake.
Yeah. It's amazing to me that. So I guess a lot of the stuff I see is it's educational. It's great. You know, I love going along to plays, and I love going, like, when I'm a judge, if I've ever been a judge in the Fringe Festival in the past, we're not supposed to talk about it, but I have been. But I love going to see the really bad theatre, because it's very often made by people who have never made a show before and who are just discovering things. And you know that they're at a point in their career that they're going to remember fondly forever, even though they're doing is...
But I reckon that's the beauty of Fringe Festival. Yeah. Anyway, it's because it is open access.
Yeah.
It's open access. So you'll see some work that you might not ever see on other stages.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And I reckon in the last Fringe, I probably saw 30 or 40 plays. And I there were no two plays, no two ways that those stories were told that were like any other one in the festival. They're all unique. They're all unique ways, not only in terms of the story that they're telling, but how they're telling that story. And it shows what vast possibilities there are in how you can make theatre. Because even in one Fringe Festival in Melbourne, where there might be 50 or 60 plays or whatever, there's more than that, but none of them have the same DNA as any of the others. And that's great. That's exciting.
The responsibility you have as a green room judge, as a panel member of La Mama, does that ever affect in the way that you do tell a story? Does it hamper it at all?
No.
Do you find that responsibility a burden at any stage?
No. No. No, it's not at all a burden. It's a really inspiring thing. It's a thing that makes you want to be better. It's a thing that makes your stories want to be as good as those other stories that you're seeing. If you see a piece of theatre that you go, wow, that's it for me. Like probably one of the best pieces of writing I saw last year was Patricia Cornelius's play Savages. I don't know anyone who saw that play who didn't think, wow, you know?
Yeah.
And when you experience a piece of theatre like that, it's like, oh, there's a little, you know, there's that little jealousy kind of thing of like, I want to do that. I want people to be saying this wow about me too. But it also, it makes you realize how the simplicity, the importance of simplicity and the importance of just doing the kind of basic things really, really well and not being swept up by things that don't matter. I guess. And I'm actually in the process right now today, with 3 weeks to go of this play that Lauren and I are working on in terms of directing, thinking, you know what? We just need to do the simple things really well and forget about bells and whistles and it'll be great. So, yeah.
So we're nearly coming to the end of what's been a wonderful interview. Mm. We've just got a couple more questions. So obviously you just mentioned the La Mama show we're working on.
You mentioned that before, though.
Yeah. Multiple times. <Hey. laughs>
Well played. I'm pretty excited, okay?
February 19th, yeah. March 2nd, La Mama.
Give it a plug. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Book your tickets at. Anyway, have you got any other projects that you're working on at the moment, or things in the pipeline that you're excited about or that you can talk about at all?
I have things in the pipeline that I'm excited about, but I really need to get all the La Mama stuff out of the way and then I can concentrate on them, and I can't really talk about them at the moment because it's their stage. But I'm about to start studying ridiculously, doing a masters of creative writing, I think it's called, at VCA, which is this unexpected thing, and it's kind of ridiculous thing, but I'm excited about that because I've actually never sat down and studied how to be a writer before. I don't know if it's something you can actually do, but I'm really interested in approaching writing from different angles and stuff. So that's going to be a lot of this year, doing that.
Can I ask a bit of an interesting question here?
I hope so.
Well, you know.
Yeah, come on, one interesting question.
It's always subjective. talking about storytelling, if there was a movie that summed up your life, is there anyone that comes to your mind?
There is.
There
are several, but probably the one that I think of sometimes is And I haven't seen it for a while, actually. So I'm like, I wonder if it still speaks to me how I feel now. Is the movie Adaptation by Charlie Kaufman with Nicolas Cage playing a role that, yeah, when my brother went and saw this movie, I didn't know he'd gone and seen it, but he rang me just laughing his head off, just going, "Addie, I just saw a movie about you. And I knew exactly what he was talking about, because when I saw that movie too, it was like, my God, this is exactly what it feels like to be like, this is what our place is called.
This is what it feels like.
But this is exactly what it feels like to be who I am and where I am and how ridiculous I am and how hopeless I am at life. And actually, there's another one that the movie that probably most impacted me in the most kind of profound way was the movie Before Sunset, which I don't know if you know that movie. It's part of a trilogy. There's been Before Sunrise, oh, yes. Before Sunset, yes. And Before Midnight, which just came out last year.
Yeah.
And it's funny because two people who are at different stages of their life in each of the movie, and they happen to be exactly the same age that I am. So when I saw the first one, I was their age. When I saw the second one, I was their age. When I saw the third one, the second one spoke entirely in every aspect to my soul when I saw it. Mm. Neither the first one or the third one did that.
Yeah.
But that movie Before Sunset was just... Oh.
5 years or 10 years between the filming of each
one? I think
one?
More like... Seven or eight years.
Yeah, okay. And I guess the last question I have as well is just advice for anyone starting out in the industry. What would you say to them if they're going, you know what, I want to follow writing, I want to be an actor.
I want to be Adam Cass.
I want to be Adam J.A. Cass. What would you say?
I would say, look, resilience is a really important thing. I mean, I guess be really aware of the goals that you want to set for yourself. Like, I do have this long game goal, and I think that long game goal works for me and frustrates the hell out of other people in my life. Like, they are a lot more impatient than me, and that impatience, I think, sometimes gets them places. But for me, the most important thing is just to keep on making work, just to keep on making work always. Just make something, and it doesn't actually... If I'm talking to playwrights right now, it doesn't have to be a play. It can be anything. It can be anything that engages you creatively, that gets you your soul working, anything. Just keep on doing it. Just keep on doing it. Just keep on doing it. And don't for one second let the how hard it is let you tell yourself it's too hard. If it's too hard, it's too hard, and you won't get anywhere. Like, if you let yourself be dominated by that, you won't get anywhere.
Bit of a battle of attrition in life.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, there are other ways of approaching things. Absolutely, there are other ways, but that's how to be Adam Cass. Probably.
Thank you so much, Adam. This has been really amazing and rewarding, and I think I speak on behalf of both of us, Nick.
Certainly do.
Really appreciate you giving us the opportunity to interview you.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, that was pretty amazing.
Very honest, passionate conversation.
I've known Adam for a long time and obviously worked with him before, but you've met Adam previously, but I don't know how much of his work you've seen or...
Well, as I said, it was fairly new, all that for me. But I think one of the things that I most took out of that was this idea of create, you know, this, I think we said it, the battle of attrition. You've just got to keep creating work. And we spoke to Adam afterwards, and it's this idea of, you could create 100 works and only one could be successful.
Yeah.
And that's crazy to think that, but that one is the thing that drives you, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and that there's joy in that drive to get to the one, that it's not all about, oh, this is just hard. You know, every step along the way, you need to find the joy in that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I guess I was getting at this idea of, obviously I know Adam quite well, but all sorts of things came up in that before that I didn't know about him or views I haven't heard expressed. But I did really like what he was saying about, you know, he has the opportunity to see so much theatre. And when you go to the theatre, if there's one moment, one performance, one, you know, sequence of lines, one note of music that completely resonates with you, that you really connect to, that makes it one, that's worth striving for. And
it's
similar to what you're saying about create. This idea that we strive for those moments And maybe one day we'll make a masterpiece where all those moments happen in completely the right order for everyone. And, you know, but even if they don't, each moment is enough.
Well, there you have it. The first podcast is wrapped. I mean, you must be really excited to be working with Adam.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We open in just over a week and it's been really great to be working with Adam again. We originally co-wrote a show that we performed at La Mama for two seasons at La Mama in 2006-07.
Oh, yeah, back together again. The Killing Fever.
Yep. So we're back together again and it's really great to be doing something where you have that sense of how far we've come, how we've grown.
Great.
You don't always get the opportunity to really reflect on that, I suppose.
Yeah.
What about you? You must be pretty excited. You're about to head off on some South American adventures.
I am, yeah. I'm off to South America for a month. I'm going with my girlfriend. It's her 30th. Yeah. But you were talking about, I guess, seeing how much you've grown. This is, for me, an opportunity of growth, really. And
yeah.
I mean, we're going to Chile, Argentina, Peru. We're going to be over in Brazil for Carnival.
So oh, wow.
If you see me in my outfit, come and say hi.
I look forward to photos.
And what have you got going on at the moment, Lauren?
I guess the other thing I'm organising at the moment is a three-day workshop in late March with a teacher, Ale T. Miller. He's originally a New York director, but he's done a whole heap of other things, trained in Fitzmaurice voice work, and he currently teaches at the LaSalle School in Singapore. But anyway, I trained with him in Bali last year. And he works a lot with Grotowski, Mask, Chekhov. He really focuses on accessing character through physical work. And, I mean, he's a great teacher. It's pretty powerful stuff. Yeah. So I'll put a link to the class on the website.
Please
so
do.
If anyone's interested, check it out.
And you've talked me into going. I'm going to be there as well. So
if anyone wants to work with Nick, this is your chance.
or I'll be able to review and let you know how it went.
What about you? What have you got planned for when you're back from your travels?
Yeah, well, at the moment I'm just concentrating on traveling, but when I'm back, I do have a web series that I wrote called A Non-Event that I'm really keen to get up, work with a few actors that I know, and there'll be a possible campaign, so I'm sure you'll hear about it and hear me banging on about it on here in future podcasts.
Web series, that's pretty exciting.
Very exciting.
That's sort of the new thing, you know, it's kind of replaced, well, not, there's lots of short films still out there, but that's the new medium or whatever.
It is, yeah, which is exciting. There's a lot of websites that support web series too, which is great. But that's enough about me. I did want to, on this podcast, do a little bit of a plug. Hopefully every month we'll be able to plug a great show that's kicking around. And there is a great one coming up. So if you're around Kyneton on the 15th of February, it's a show called Kiosk by Wes Snelling. So it's a show that I believe has been shown in Melbourne originally, and it's a musical comedy set around his life growing up in the Kyneton Caravan Park. And he has the amazing opportunity to actually do the show in the Kyneton Caravan Park.
Oh, so that's fantastic.
Really cool. So if you've got an opportunity, 15th of Feb, as I said, tickets are $20 from the trybooking.com website. And if you haven't seen Wes, he's amazing. He's got a character called Tina Del Twist, who is just amazing. Different show, of course, but well worth the price of admission.
Great. Well, Kyneton's not that far away. So.
No. Not from Melbourne, anyway. If you're listening other places, it might be a little bit of a drive.
We apologise. So I guess that brings us to the end of our very first podcast.
Yeah, we hope you enjoyed the first podcast and got as much out of Adam's interview as we did.
And we're going to put a link up on our site, about.me/theactofstorytelling, that's our official website, to Adam's script for I Love You Bro, so that if you want to order yourselves a copy, you can.
And that's the other thing too, we've got obviously the website where you get the podcast, but do like us on Facebook and Twitter, and hopefully you can join us next month when we are interviewing Anita Quayle. She's from another storytelling field, which is she's a musician, worked with some amazing artists. So continue to join us.
And we have to thank Anita for our amazing podcast music.
Making us sound very professional. Thank you, Anita. Catch you next time.
Thanks.